Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Дамы и господа, добро пожаловать в Prevail. Это второй сезон нашей борьбы с криминальными сволочами. Ваш ведущий Грег О'Леари.
I'm Greg O'Leary. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show from History Falls Apart and the brand spanking new CowPAC Political Action Committee. Ryan Byrne is here. This is a fun conversation. I wanted to have him come on because the last couple of weeks, really the last month, we've talked about some heavy things on the podcast. We've talked about the end of democracy, and we've talked about the war in Ukraine, and we've talked about climate change and all this sort of horrible stuff. And I said, Ryan will come on and we'll talk about, you know, funnier things. And we do, you know, we cover a lot of ground. This is the only podcast I think that ever existed where we talk about Alanis Morissette and Sumerian dick jokes in the same podcast, in the same section of the podcast, in fact. And it all makes sense. You know, Ryan's doing these things with History Falls Apart and now with the new CowPAC, which are funny. They're like comic films that are satirical. And so I wanted to talk to him about that, about what comedy even is these days, what satire is, what irony is. Is it dead? Is it possible to even be ironic anymore in this weird age that we live in? I don't know. So I wanted to have him on to discuss it. I'm trying to think what else we cover. Lots of things. Like, it's all over the map. Literally all over the map, because it starts out in the Fertile Crescent and winds up out here, you know, in the United States. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. History Falls Apart. Go follow them on the Twitter. It's just at History Falls. CowPAC is going to be a thing with his creative partner, Devin's Cow. And we know Devin's Cow because Devin's Cow started off, as Ryan put it, as a shitposting account on Twitter to poke fun at Devin Nunes, a extremely corrupt congressman from California, wound up getting sued by Devin Nunes, which is ridiculous and should be illegal. And because of that, got a lot more notoriety than maybe she was expecting, which is great, and became, again, in Ryan's phrasing, and I agree, a folk hero. So shout out to Devin's Cow, shout out to the CowPAC, shout out to History Falls Apart. This is a fun conversation. We're going to be right back with Ryan Byrne. If you've got a good trade, chances are you've already got a good job. If you haven't, you better get one. Right-wing chaos agent. Now there's a good trade. At Perplex Tech,
we got a 6-month training program for chaos agents. It's thorough because we work you hard. By the time you're done, your moral compass will be completely destroyed, and you'll be willing to say or do anything. With a professional provocateur working beside you, maybe it's Jack Probiotic, maybe it's Laura Groomer, it may even be Fuck Johnson. At Perplex Tech, you'll learn all the tricks of the trade. How to craft shitposts, how to generate dumb memes, how to dox, how to direct bot armies, how to work Hunter Biden's laptop into casual conversation, and most of all, how to grift. It's all in your training program. When you complete your training, and we recommend you for an entry-level job harassing women journalists online, you'll be a professional tool. Give us a call and see what financial assistance towards your training you might be entitled to from the Koch brothers, the Bradley Foundation, the Federalist Society, the NRA, and the Russian mob. Now, I can't phone you. You have to take the first step and phone us. Call 1-800-277-4653. That's 1-800-ASSHOLE. Learn your new trade at Perplex Tech, where far right ain't far enough. And now, back to the show. Ryan Byrne, welcome to the Prevail Podcast.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
I am good. I thought I had a lot of books in my office here, and you put me to shame. I know this is a terrible way to start an audio podcast, but I just have to say, you have behind you 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, like legit bookshelves. And you showed me before the panoramic of the room that you are now in, and it is surrounded by books. So you're sitting in the middle of a gigantic room surrounded by books.
There are about, I think there are 27 bookcases in this room. And like it's about 5,000 books. And I think there are like another 6,000 downstairs. One of the things that didn't occur to me till later in life was that as I'm doing historical research on the 18th century, 19th century, and I'm looking at this project I was working on about the personal libraries of the founding fathers, like what did the Federalist Papers authors have in their personal libraries that influenced their conception of human nature and human condition, which informed what they thought would be probable and likely and appropriate restraints on human ambition, right, in United States government. So I'm reconstructing like what their libraries look like. And what I realized was is that the biggest personal libraries on the North American continent were about maybe a quarter to a third the size of mine. And so I feel really okay about that. Like I feel...
I think that's good. Well, you know, but there were fewer books then though.
You that's
know,
true. It's true.
Like, but the whole time you were saying that, I was trying to make a joke saying, oh, probably, you know, Our Dumb Century by The Onion or something.
For sure. But, you know, when you, I'm not an American historian, at least by training, but like when you're reading Madison and you feel like you're a little bit out of your depth and you've got no business talking about him, and then you're reading through whatever, Federalist 10, and you're seeing all these references to, well, you know, a president would never do that. A man of honor would never do that. Because as we read in the story of Lycurgus, the lawgiver, and you're like, wait a second, that dude didn't even exist, right? Like that's a myth, right? But it's being cited as if it's like empirical political science. And to the extent that like what we believe is honorable and restrainable by a human's conduct and sense of self is influenced by these texts. And we are going to base a whole system on government with certain loopholes that we have seen exploited precisely because of that oversight. Then you start to feel a little bit more comfortable going out of Madison, you know, when you realize I've got more books. I've read everything. Like, we get to the point where you're like, you have read everything that Madison has ever read.
That's impressive, though, because I remember learning, you know, there's so many books now. I remember somebody saying that the last educated person who could possibly and maybe did read everything was Coleridge. Samuel Taylor Coleridge, and whatever, that's the early 1800s, I think. And after that, there's too many books. It was impossible to do.
Or at least whatever white people thought was really important for you to read by that point.
That's a given. In the canon of whatever the hell it was. And that's interesting. So now we're talking about history. You are the proprietor of the Twitter page at History Falls, which is History Falls Apart.
Right.
Which is really wonderful. You do it's very funny, but it's also I can say it now that I've introduced you in your element. It's so book smart funny.
because there's so many like arcane references mixed with low pop culture references from now. I love shit like that where it's the mix of the two, you know, the really highfalutin stuff like you were just talking about. What was Madison reading? And then, you know, Ted Cruz is the Zodiac Killer.
Yeah. Kind
of smashed together. So it's really good stuff. Now, how did that come about? Yeah, what gave you the idea to do it like that? What does the name come from? What does it mean?
It was a total accident. So my creative partner, whose name is Sovereign Sire, she's a stand-up comic, poet, author, former adult performer, strange mix, professor and the porn star. We had this idea, oh, this would be kind of a great brand. There's something there. We don't know what we're going to produce, but there's some shtick there to produce.
Certainly, and I mean, Gilligan's Island 2.0 is definitely
certainly that.
Like a few more people, but yeah.
And I had been doing some, after I had left academia, I was doing some stuff in reality TV, like learning how to develop TV shows, how to edit things. And I don't know, one thing led to another, and NBC or MSNBC, someone in that 30 Rock had got a hold of an old reel of me from a while ago when someone was trying to do a TV show about me from another life anyway,
okay,
as an archaeology show. And so I fly out there, they fly me out to 30 Rock and I go up there and they're like all these producers from all these different networks. It was just very surreal experience. And we're talking for like 3 hours and I'm thinking, don't you guys have jobs to get back to? And at the end, they start talking about, well, what kind of show do you want to do? And I was like, well, not anything with me, which was, to them, it sounded ridiculous because who turns down a TV show? I said, you know, I'm not anything. They said, well, okay, if you think that building a brand is important, you know, you should really have a podcast. Now, I didn't want to have a podcast. And this is no offense to you, but like, I feel like there are like two kind of podcasts. Like I like scripted podcasts because they keep moving along, right? But then you have podcasts where—
Like this one, which is—
Right, right. Yeah, it's very well scripted. This is all, I'm reading right off of the notes that you sent me, which came from the oil and gas industry, right? And it's got Exxon letterhead. So we'll get to that, by the way. Yeah, because that's anybody who doesn't like Elon Musk must be. Okay, so I go back and they're like, I gotta do a podcast. I don't know anything about podcasts and I'm researching. Actually, I think that's how I found some of your stuff. Anyway, so we can't figure it out. Like we were flying to LA and like doing stuff in studios and just like figuring out what it is. And we just don't know. And it was sometime during the impeachment where we were thought, well, you know, let's make some videos and set up a Twitter account and put them out there and like see like what sticks. Let's make like 5 or 6 different things that are totally different, like totally serious, urbane, you know, political hard hitting stuff, dick jokes, you know, like bringing down the patriarchy. This is a big thing for me, you know, to even more absurd recreations of that scene from Downfall, the Nazi bunker film that everybody like wants to put captions on. So I was just like, let's just do all sorts of weird stuff. And so there's no theme, but the whole point was like, we were workshopping things to see, I don't know if it got any interest. I didn't even know anything about Twitter. And then a couple of things just kind of caught fire. And that was kind of unexpected. We didn't really think anybody was going to look at anything. It was really kind of like more like jokes for us. We did this one episode that was called More Dumb Civil War, which was like a takeoff on Ken Burns, right? It's like, it's exactly like the music and the images and the pacing and everything. Cause everybody's, you know, on the right talking about civil war is coming. And so we're like, what would that look like? You know, if Ken Burns 100 years from now did that thing and just kind of like caught fire. And then over the course of like the next year or so, then we had, I don't know, 3 or 4 million views from all these different things and 60 films in the can at that point. It just kind of took on a life of its own. And, but what was cool about it was then suddenly that COVID comes. And so we got stuck doing that. Like we all were inside and I'm like, all right, I guess I'm making Civil War dick joke films as like
there
my
are worse
personal
things, you know,
no behind. There aren't like that's important to me because I can only make a very small contribution to the end of the patriarchy. So if I can die having elevated the dick joke to an art form, then I feel like that's, you know, I'll have done my share.
I feel like the quarantine was sort of like musical chairs where everybody was dancing around and then suddenly it was like, okay, go quarantine now, and everyone sort of ran for the chair that they were closest to. And then they had to sit in that chair for 2 years. So that was your chair. It was the urbane dick joke chair.
Can I ask you a question? Like 9, 10, 11, mm-hmm. what did you want to do for a living?
Good question. I don't know, because I wanted to do something creative. I knew I wanted to do something creative, you know, probably something with writing or with music, but that's as far as I knew. I didn't know what form it would take yet.
I remember reading, I hate to be anecdotal about this, because it could have just as easily been some like peer-reviewed journal, but it's probably like a red book in a doctor's waiting office when I was 8. I remember reading about this thing that says, you know, people are most happy doing like whatever it was that they wanted to be when they were like 10 years old. Huh. And when I was 10 years old, my dad brought home one of those really early video cameras, you know, that like you had to lug the VCR with you.
Oh yeah.
You
know, yeah.
On a power pack that like,
or you had it left. on the shoulder strap.
Uh-huh. And you couldn't do any editing because you would have to have two VCRs at the same time. And you have to like coordinate the buttons, and nobody younger than Gen X like will appreciate this. And I was obsessed with this. I grew up in LA as like a theater film kid. And my brother and I just like made these home movies the whole time that kind of started to branch into political satire. And since you couldn't edit them, you had to have a linear sense of the story.
Yeah, we did this. The beginning. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You couldn't be like, oh, we'll fix it in post. There was no post. You had to have your script from beginning to end, and every shot had to be perfect and everything, because you couldn't go back. And, you know, we kind of went our separate ways. My brother became a comic book artist and I went into academia. And then sometime, you know, he started working on this graphic novel and Universal bought it and Ron Howard bought it. And they were going to make this big movie out of it or whatever. And it kind of opened up weird doors into the kind of creative people that we were meeting at the same time. But it was also at a time when academics couldn't do pop stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like we had to be very, very urbane, you know, about our research. And, you know, now it's a totally different story. You know, like I could be, you know, a Chippendales dancer. I mean, I couldn't, but, you know, I that would be okay probably with tenure and promotion now. you know what I mean?
So, especially if you were studying like, you know, like you were talking about the Madison and the Benjamin Franklin and you were dancing on their Chippendale furniture.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, we've got this whole cartoon series that we're doing about that actually right now. but there's a parallel there, I think, between the way that our political discourse has flattened out, like into, I'm trying to say this without it sounding like elitist, but kind of into the vernacular, right? Where our whole notion of caste about like, you know, here are like educated, literate, career politicians, learned men or whatever in the founder sense, to whom we entrust the responsibility of making wise decisions, and the rest of us are vulgarians who are illiterate, you know, and, you know, trust them to represent us, that all that's been flattened out for good or ill. But part of what it's done is it's done it culturally, and it's done it rhetorically, right? So that the politicians who do the best now, who are the most popular, who attract kind of personality cults, are the ones who tend to be the most vulgar, the most childish, the most bandwagony. If you look at Ted Cruz's Twitter feed, I mean, they're sophomoric and there are attempts at satire that fall flat. And I mean, you can say all those things, but like, you know, just as a matter of percentages, you know, I think is this guy who presents himself as an evangelical Christian. And like the ratio of really like cutting caustic critiques versus things that he's saying that are uplifting and positive about the culture we want to improve and the country that we want to create, like that's an interesting ratio. And I don't think that that's even unique to him. Does that make sense? You know what I'm saying?
It's
like,
sure.
There's just so much more negative.
If you look back on the political thing, even if you listen to the tapes of the way that people talk, like remember during the McCarthy hearings, it was the guy that, you know, and he sounded like that elevated voice. Have you no sense of decency, sir? Mm-hmm. At long last, have you no sense of decency? The world turns. It's like the voices you do on your things. Like it's this it's called North Atlantic, I think, that which no one actually really talked like that. They just all.
No, yeah, it was an affectation. Yeah. Which is interesting, right? Which is interesting because it presents this ideal that, yeah, that whole notion. I mean, yeah, to backtrack, yeah, a lot of our films have these. You know, they use a lot of archival footage and they present themselves as like 1930s or 1950s, you know, newsreel, you know, kinds of things, or, you know, educational films that they'd show in school and indoctrinate people. But like you're saying that whether it's the BBC voice, you know, or whether it's the Walter Winchell, you know, today in America, you can kindly see, you know, that kind of thing. You know, the American housewife loves her shoes. Then
well, some things haven't changed,
right? Is that it's like it's the fact that it's unreal and that it's elevated and that it's alien to all of our experience kind of gives it what sounds ridiculous to us now. At the time, it was intentional because it creates an aura of authority that is unassailable, in the same way that like stilted political rhetoric used to do that until very recently. You know, once we started to get more, you know, like once you have CNN and stuff like that, and like you have different kinds of perspectives on the debates, presidential debates especially, you start to get like five or six of them, you get spin zones, you know, that get to analyze them, you know, in the years past, just the three main networks, which opens the door to a lot of aesthetic and theatrical interpretation of how they're performing. You know, you start to see that kind of disgruntled impatience from us about the way that politicians answer their questions. And, you know, like how many politicians have we known throughout our lifestyle that basically live in terror 24/7 about saying the wrong thing, where a gaffe is the worst thing that can happen to you? I mean, if you contrast what any of the usual suspects say on a regular day with Howard Dean being canceled because he yelled one time.
I know it's,
yeah. I mean, and we're not removed from that by very much, you know, in terms of what was considered, I guess, what dispositive of competence to become the leader of the free world, that if you screamed, then you must be unhinged and don't give them nuclear codes, you know? And now we don't really particularly seem to care. And a lot of that is done by taking this once upon a time world where you could ask a question of a vice presidential candidate or something like that, and they would say, you know, I want to answer that question, but first I'd like to address the shit we were talking about just before for 45 seconds and then get back to the, you know, and so it's like, we all knew that that was the way that it happened. And everybody in the audience knows that they're obfuscating. I don't think anybody is like fooled by that. It's just that since both sides do it, you just give them all a pass. And I think one of the things about the Trump phenomenon that gets, I guess, underappreciated by the left is how powerful and resonant and personal his propensity for vulgarity and profanity, you know, were, because that's the way we all speak. Yeah. I mean, even people who 20 years ago would have like shied or been horrified or clutching their pearls, like when George Bush, you know, I remember George Bush like getting on a hot mic calling, oh, that's that reporter from the New York Times. He's a major league asshole. And Cheney said, yeah, big time. And that was like this huge international incident, you know, that he had said that. Like that would be nothing now. And now you see like all these little grannies on Twitter, you know, like you say one thing and they're like, you know, okay, you know, you groomer cocksucker. And you're like, where did that come from? Like, lady, like.
I think it has, and assumes it is a lady. I mean, I think it has something to do with who also the politicians now are, because we've had, I mean, you could say Reagan definitely was an actor. I think Kennedy was sort of a performer in his way. Mm-hmm. Obama is definitely, he isn't a screen actor, but he's a performer for sure, in the way that he delivers speeches. And Trump is a fucking actor. That's what he is. He's an actor in the sense of he's a bad actor. And he's also an actor. He was on the damn TV show playing the part of the billionaire that well enough that people believed it. So not only are we drifting away from and merging, or what did you say? Collapsing the two, you know, the people that are running for office are performers. We're taking them, even these Republican, you know, someone has done, I think it's Chad Loader did the thread about it. All of these GOP, the young GOP Congress critters are all from that Explore Talent website. I mean, they all have backgrounds in, not even in theater, in failed theater. They're failed actors.
Yeah.
They have that, you know, that button. And I think part of being an actor in that way is wanting to be famous, which is also I think part of what the draw is and what the appeal is for people now more than ever to go into politics, because you're going to be famous if you go into politics. You can't help it. It's impossible to, you know, to be private anymore, which is another casualty of this.
And there's nothing disqualifying. I mean,
well, if you're a Republican,
if you're so, yeah. Well, you know, time will tell, you know, I mean, it's, it depends to be, you know, be open to the possibility. I mean, it's, we, you know, it within the burgeoning movement, you know, to which I'm partially sympathetical of like fighting fire with fire. We don't really know what that is going to look like from the other side as things get more desperate, you know, and things that you and I would be really intolerant of now, because it's just gauche. You know, like, I mean, just that, I mean, like, just like, why would you say that? It's like, really, like that split infinitive you're going to use in a State of the Union, you know?
I always think about the States of the Union address too, because they is it States of the Union or State of the Union? Or I probably State of the Union addresses.
States of the Union. Yeah, it would be States of the Union. Yeah. Okay,
good. It would be States of the Union, he said, as he sipped his wine. The
My grammar improves with my blood alcohol content.
it's a lot of panache. Okay, I want to talk about satire because I have a question for you about that. But first, we have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Ryan Byrne.
Hey, it's Kimberly, host of the Start Me Up podcast. If you like your politics with some loose talk and salty language, you're going to love my show. I interview the coolest people like Mary Trump, Kathy Griffin, and DNC chair Jamie Harrison. The Start Me Up podcast has an easygoing, casual style and a strong emphasis on left-leaning politics. We also have frank discussions about sex and more than a few spirited rants. Just visit patreon.com/startmeup or wherever you get your podcasts and start listening today.
Ryan Byrne, History Falls Apart. Welcome back. Okay, I have a question about satire. What you do is satire. On my little comic bits on my show here, I try to do mostly satire. But I feel like in this age, satire is really difficult because irony is almost, it's just hard to get that going. And I wonder if it's completely dead or if it's even effective. And I'm thinking in particular, there's a guy, I don't know his name. He has that, it's called... Birds Aren't Real. Have you heard about this guy?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And his thing is that he's pretending to be QAnon to the nth power with this crazy conspiracy theory that birds aren't real and that all the birds died and that all the birds that you see now are just homing devices spying on us or something like that.
Right.
And this is obviously satirical, but I wonder, as clever as it is it effective or does it just confuse the fuck out of everybody? Because I feel like stuff like that sometimes just confuses the fuck out of everybody.
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, it's the complication with satire is like, I think it means something to different people. And we kind of take words like satire and parody and comedy, humor, irony, sarcasm, and we kind of mix them all together as if they're the same. Mm-hmm. And there is a lot of cross-pollination. And I don't know, for me, like, satire is this umbrella, and satire doesn't have to be funny. You know, that's the thing. In fact, in its origins in like Greek comedy or Greek rhetoric, it's not necessarily funny sometimes. It's like, what is humor to you? I mean, actually, strangely, like the best definition that I've heard was from Buzz Aldrin trying to answer a Sacha Baron Cohen interview question about whether the moon was real. And the definition of comedy he gave, and that was a lot to unpack there. Yeah. He says, well, comedy is the mixture of the real and the absurd. Right? Is that you're taking what you know and you introduce something that is so obviously untrue, right? That it jars you to realize, well, wait a minute, maybe there are elements of the absurd in the real.
Yeah,
that we're seeing to different, you know, because your absurd is different from my absurd. Clearly, you can go on Twitter and spend 30 seconds there and understand that absurdity is a total cultural relativism, right? Irony, on the other hand, to me, is kind of like more understated, right? If humor is about overstatement, irony is about like subtlety, I guess. Now, and then I guess like the more robust form of irony is sarcasm. That, I mean, I don't know. There's a taxonomy.
I feel like
there.
Irony, I always thought that irony had to have an implied like reversal. Like it was something.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Like
for
sure. You're saying something that's the opposite of what you mean.
Right. But I think it's like, what is the expression of it though? Like, is it, yeah. I guess what I would say is if it's subtle and it requires you to have to unpack it and think about it and be like, oh, I see what you did there. Like that's irony. If it's over the top and you like take a gut check when it happens, that's sarcasm. Do you know what I mean? I kind of see them as like degrees of that like same creature. In a realm like Twitter, you know, it's kind of like the difference between like Monty Python British humor of like the late 60s, which required you to be like slow down and like see subtle allusions or jokes and something like that versus just something that's in your face. And with social media being both, I guess, catering to and an incubator for attention deficit, you know, disorders, I said that in the loveliest, you know, way, that it's like you have to have something that's going to hit people right away. Like subtlety doesn't really always work, but some things do. I mean, that was one of the trial balloons we were doing because, you know, some of the films that we've done, you know, for most people, there's a 2-minute and 20-second cap on videos that you can upload on Twitter historically. I think when you like the Twitter Plus or whatever it is allows you to do longer ones. But a long time ago, we got a waiver. And so we can put actually like 10-minute videos up there. And we did, we put a 10-minute video up there one time and people were saying, no one is ever going to watch this. There's no chance anybody's going to watch this because they just don't have the attention, you know, even if you're just scrolling and there's a video and you don't even know it's a video, you know, until you're halfway down because it never actually starts. And that first one got like 500,000 views. And
it's a lot of views.
And if it had just died, I would have said, okay, well, I won't try that again. Yeah. But it was encouraging because, like, you know, some of our stuff is really, it's I wouldn't say it's full length documentary, but it's as long as Twitter will allow us to put up.
Yeah, you know? That's part of it. That's part of its charm too. You know, it's not afraid to expand the. I'm going to throw some examples at you and tell me if it's irony, if it's satire.
Oh my God. Like, okay. All right.
Because there are no right or wrong answers here.
Okay.
I just want to
probably there are.
I just want to talk about funny. Like I always thought in my mind, satire was in Dr. Strangelove when they're in the war room and then the general and the Russian guy get in the fist fight and the president says, there's no fighting in here. This is the war room. I don't know what that is, but that is satire, but that's how I defined it. But is it? I don't know.
I think so. Oh yeah, I think so. Well, I just finished actually yesterday reading this book by Daniel Ellsberg, which I didn't realize that before he had access to the Pentagon Papers, he was a nuclear first strike planner. From the Eisenhower to the Nixon administrations. He was on loan from Rand. And so he had like the very top clearance about like first strike. And he knew all these details about like dead man switches in first strike stuff that even the president was not aware of, like about how this, you know, this like conventional notion that like, oh, well, when we attack the Soviet Union, we'll kill their leaders. So to impair their ability to, you know, strike back at us. But what they didn't know is that you have this doomsday weapon concept, which means that what happens is that when command and control is knocked out, there is an automated system that kicks in. And so if your nuclear base detects a nuclear missile coming in, it just launches automatically. And as it's passing by other missile silos on the way, it will send a message to them that activates them. And basically your whole arsenal will go out and, you know, end the human species and create, because it creates nuclear winter, right? Like it, at this point, the kiloton yield of our bombs, it doesn't require very much to, you know, kill everybody now. We think about it in terms of the blast radius, but like, it's like, you know, the sky will darken for decades, all the plants will die, everybody dies. I have no idea where it was going.
You were spoiling the end of Dr. Strangelove.
Oh, I guess. Oh, yeah. So he goes to see Dr. Strangelove in 1964, is it? And with all this intel that he can't share with anyone, that even the president doesn't know, with his friend. And he and his friend, I think from Rand, they come out and he says, like, he's horrified because he's like, how did they know this? He says, that wasn't satire that was a documentary. Like just okay. Because it was all predicated on the notion that like any rogue pilot could basically start World War III, regardless of whether there was any directive from the president. Like the whole notion that the football is this basically act of theater.
Yeah.
Because there are like all these levels of delegation, you know, like Eisenhower delegated to all these naval commanders who had, you know, submarines with missiles, you know, if we're out of range, because they would, it was the '50s, you know, you couldn't always get a hold of Washington and shit looks bad. I authorize you to start World War III. So, you know, you got those guys and they're like, well, I'm not the guy with the turnkey. So they're like, hey, Lieutenant Junior, whatever, if something happens, you can start World War III. And it was like, there was no accounting for like what the delegation was down the line. And so it's like, basically you find out, oh my God, like the plumber and the janitor on the submarine could have started World War III at any minute.
We're lucky to be alive.
Yeah. No record keeping, you know? So, yeah, exactly. Tell your plants you love them, you know, while they're still here.
Okay, here's my next example. Pulling us away from nuclear Armageddon. Okay, there's an episode of The Simpsons where Bart Simpson is running for class president against the nerd Martin Prince. And Martin is hanging up a sign that says, a vote for Bart is a vote for anarchy. And then it scrolls down the hallway and Bart is hanging up the exact same sign. That's it. I don't know what that is either. It's funny.
Yeah.
There's well, no right know, answer. I just want to
there's an interesting there's an interesting like epistemological thing, right? It's like when I think about like people on the left who were the first people to kind of remind our political landscape that Goebbels said, you know, whatever it is you're doing, accuse the other side of doing it. And that was nice for a couple of years. Until the right started to say the same thing, except they didn't get it from any familiarity with Third Reich, you know, rhetorical studies. They got it from liberal memes, which they just changed. You know what I mean? Like, it's like liberal memes are like the farm system, you know? Like when, like conservative memes break down into two categories. There's like the ones that are just bad and don't make any sense at all. Okay. And then there are ones that are simply reappropriations of historians who have actually, you know, made those comparisons. And it's like, I think that's a great observation, is that they become meaningless. I mean, especially the more poignant and dangerous they are. They become meaningless because even the pieces of evidence now are indistinguishable. But there's going to be a cycle because I think that it's kind of going in a Mobius strip now. I mean, here's the interesting thing: like, you'd think that if 96% of Democrats were you know, pedophile groomers, we would have heard about it before 3 weeks ago. You know, like I didn't get the memo, but like, I just know that like on a certain day in like April, everybody was saying, I mean, I don't know what there's probably some AM radio station that we need to go back and look at. They got really good ratings on like October or whatever, April 11th. But within a couple of weeks, as people started to tire of OK Groomer, which is from OK Boomer, right? I mean, like already we've got derivative of derivative, is that then people on the left started to say okay groomer back to okay groomers as a, well, let's just nip this in the bud by diluting its effectiveness, which is interesting because it doesn't usually happen that long. Like the left tends to be a little bit more on the uptake with devaluing it, you know, by appropriating. Does that make sense?
Like, yeah. It's, yeah. It's like you're subverting a hashtag too. It's the same kind of thing. I did that once. I woke up early and there was a Julian Castro was doing something. I forget what it was. And that was when I wake up at 6 a.m. New York time and something has been trending, it's because it's lunchtime in Moscow. It's pretty easy to figure out why. So I went in and I started using that hashtag for whatever. And I appropriated it. I neutralized it. I shot it out of the sky because, you know, enough people then took it and turned it and, you know, to the same thing, like saying, okay, groomer, now it's become meaningless. All right, last point about irony, and then I want to move on to history.
Okay.
Okay. The Alanis Morissette song, isn't it ironic? This is my theory about the song.
That's done more damage to Western civilization. I mean, not the aesthetic. I mean, I'm not an art critic, so I can't. But
she's not saying, isn't it ironic? What she's asking us, is this irony? She's legitimately asking, isn't it ironic? She doesn't know. She's asking if it's ironic, and it's up to us, the listener, to say, no, it's not ironic when it rains on your wedding day. That's what the song means.
Okay, one, I concur that she doesn't know. But let me just point out, it's not a flaw, it's just an observation, right? If she doesn't know, and every single one is not irony, and she's posing it as a rhetorical question, because she's just asking questions. I'm not saying it's like Tucker Carlson, I'm just asking the question. But let's just say it's an innocent, I'm asking the question. And then you want to say, but she doesn't really know. Doesn't seem like there's a kind of disingenuous artifice in the asking. Like, she should know at least one of them. Like, or, you know, at this point, she's a gazillionaire and can afford a dictionary.
Right.
Before she, I mean, I know that stars past a certain point, you know, like they issue like any kind of editorial input, right? For like, you know, at a certain point, like after Magical Mystery Tour, George Martin was really no longer allowed to weigh in.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, we know what we're doing. Like, just, you know, turn on the lights and the machines and we'll tell you. But I don't know. But it's a great question, because it hasn't it become this kind of cultural sign? I mean, a touchstone. I mean, maybe more for people our age.
Yeah.
But, you know, it didn't seem like when it first came out and that song was so popular that there was a lot of pushback at the time.
I don't think there was. I think about it's become the, a...
Maybe it's because we're... Maybe it's because I'm too pedantic about it, but
it does stick in the craw. You know, it sticks in the craw.
I mean, yeah. I mean, it's really just all those scenarios are just shitty, and maybe it's just because you can't say shitty on the radio.
Yeah, like sort of when Billy Joel's singing about Bethlehem, but he just says Allentown because
I'm not gonna be forwarded to bad legal takes because I said you can't say shitty on the thing. I'm pretty sure.
No, you're fine. Sure.
I mean, you can't actually, you know what? You can, you just have to pay the fine.
What fine?
Isn't there a fine? If you say shitty on the thing, don't they, just like the FCC fines you at least. So you can say it. You just
on
my
podcast or on the,
no, on like, it. On like on FM radio,
I guess. I don't know.
I don't know.
I
so
know how it works, you know,
I mean, maybe there's just like the sanitized version.
Well, you have to pick words that sound like that. Like, you know, it's all fogged up and I can't see the sky and that kind of thing. Okay, we're getting off track.
Not that
there's a track. No, there is no track. We're just hanging anyway. But I want to talk to you about history because it is history that's falling apart. That's the title of your thing. And you are an antiquarian. You're a historian. You're a guy who has studied for real, like ancient texts and things of this nature. And apparently you read things that are not English that are like, look like, can you read Babylonic cuneiform? Like, I don't know.
We had to actually at some point I had to do kind of a canvas of what we were required to be able to know, I mean, by the time we finished. And it was something like 18 or 19 languages that we had to know in order to work in our field. It's a very, that's what I did in my 20s, you know, like, people talk about like their misspent youth. And I was like, Sumerian verbs.
Putting the in ur text, I suppose.
That's right. Yeah. Or taking it out. I mean,
have we hit the quota of Sumerian jokes? I don't know.
Oh, there's no quota of Sumerian jokes. How about this one? Just tell me if you understand this one. There's a, I don't know. It's really old Sumerian joke, but I don't get it. The shepherd, his penis. The gardener, his hairdo. Now, I don't even know if they knew what that meant at the time, but I think like embedded in that joke is that like, you know, all of our sense of humor is also relative, you know, not just like across millennia and cross languages, but even, you know, obviously online. Text has a way, anybody who's texted and has had to explain themselves by text and then became who anybody who like issued emojis became like a very frantic emoji user in order to qualify like the tone, like that was sarcasm, you know, and everybody's had a, had an argument with their girlfriend or boyfriend or spouse about something that was taken the wrong way. And the fact that we communicate with each other now writ large, not through, I mean, if we were to have this conversation by text or by DM or something like that, our interpretation of what was going on would be really different. And our patience for it would be really different. And there would be a lot more of just that thumbs up emoji, which to me means, okay, I'm done. Like that, it's like a nice way, like, okay,
it means fuck, my thumb hurts from typing on my stupid phone.
I got stuff to do.
I've got Babylonian cuneiform to pour over.
The upside of that though is like, you know, it familiarized me, introduced me to, you know, thousands and thousands of documents that predate, you know, Greco-Roman literature that we traditionally think of as like the foundation of Western civilization. But like, these would be the texts that would be like the footnotes to that, right? You know how like Whitehead used to say that like Western civilization was a footnote to Plato. And I like once wrote this article, it was like, what were Plato's footnotes, you know? Yeah. And so like, who did he steal from, you know? And it's like, people forget that Plato's writing in the 4th century BCE, but we have, you know, texts going back to, you know, 5000 BCE. And
right.
They're not unsophisticated stuff, you know? So
not everything is sophisticated as a shepherd penis gardener.
Hairstyle. That's like, yeah, that's great. Oh, cause you can make,
I know what it, whatever. I know what that was. That was the earliest iteration of a senility test that they gave to the Sumerian king.
There you go. Camera, penis, shepherd, woman. King or Nanshu had to like, his magician medicine man.
Oh God. Right.
Whoever is Ronnie Jackson, what's the Sumerian word for candy man?
I don't know. Nebuchadnezzar the first, Nebuchadnezzar the good.
It's interesting because, you know, when you're dealing with like actual despotic cultures where they're kind of making politics up as they go along, the ways in which political satire tend to manifest have to, by definition, be much more allegorical.
Right.
You know, sure. You can't just criticize the king because, you know, if you like your genitals, that's like pro tip, you know? Yeah. As a subversive thinker. So you have to couch it in other things. You make them fables, or, you know, you like make it about animals and it's parables. So like the animal is the Pharaoh and he does something like that, where it's like clearly alluding to something like that.
Right.
But that sounds kind of odd to us until you start thinking like, is that really any different from what Shakespeare is doing in, you know, casting some of his political contemporaries in historical characters? We've kind of got a long tradition in Western civilization of using metaphor and allegory to critique political contemporaries while having plausible deniability about what we're really saying. You know, it's like the safest form of showing, not telling, because you're like, I didn't. And, you know, like, I'll admit to being guilty of that, because in a lot of my films where you would normally expect there to be exposition and for me to actually lodge an opinion about like, this guy sucks or this bill sucks, is I'll find the archival footage from some, I don't know, 1949 social guidance film or speech or whatever, you know, and I'll stick it in there. So I'll have, you know, a character saying it. So it's in a sense like triangulation, where it's like there's a continuity of the argument that makes sense, but it's never me saying it. And by externalizing it, it feels not authoritative, but it feels safer. And I think one of the things that I think is really important to stress is that when you do decide to make satire comedic, That's a really deliberate and I think helpful way to encourage, if not dialogue, with conservatives or people across the aisle, but at least to kind of gain, to establish some good trust, some good faith. You know, you go through a thread and somebody posts something from the Washington Post or Breitbart and people say, oh, well, you read that, so I'm not going to even look at it, even if it's got good evidence. Okay, Breitbart may not, but I mean, the point remains, we've conditioned ourselves to prima facie rejection of information. There's something about comedy that is non-confrontational if you ease people into it, even if it's critical of your position. If it's funny, if it's genuinely funny or interesting or entertaining, or sometimes it's just the music. You're like, oh, this is, you know, the music's always the secret sauce. You're like, oh, this is, because that establishes what you're supposed to think about it. Strip the music away and it's really boring, but you're like, oh, that's supposed to be funny because the music is funny. That's supposed to be bad because that's tragic music, you know, under it. If you look at like Lincoln Project or Midas Touch and it's Don Winslow. And if you've got like apocalyptic ORF music, you know, under Trump talking about toilets, then suddenly Trump talking about toilets is Revelation chapter 5 or whatever, you know, or something like that. You know, fine. I mean, it's, I don't like, it's still a parlor trick. You know what I mean? Like I'm sympathetic to it, but that's what it is. And I think this is something that I thought about as a professor who taught pretty controversial stuff is, you know, I taught in a, you know, a small Southern liberal arts school, and I was teaching like ancient history, and that involved like doing Bible stuff. And so they were kind of like conditioned to be vituperative and combative from the get-go. But, you know, we didn't really talk about any of that stuff until like mid-semester. We talked about what is literacy like, what is a story? Like, what is a myth? Like, how are myths reinterpreted, you know, for contemporary audiences, you know, these kinds of things. So that by the time that you're actually getting into the material that you want to unpack, there's like a heuristic, there's an intellectual framework for understanding it, right? That is independent of the controversial subject matter it is. And what it does is it gives people, gives people tools under the best of circumstances and ability to see that subject slightly differently.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to go so far as saying that it's like a Trojan horse, but what you're doing is you're asking people's indulgence and their patience to hear you out.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I've been gratified by is, you know, a lot of the comments that we'll get is they're from independents and they're from conservatives who will comment and say, or DM me and say, you know, I don't agree with what you're saying, but this was really funny. And I forwarded it to all my friends.
Oh, that's good. That's what you want.
But... you know, and I think that there's a market for expanding that discourse. I just think that we have become, that word tribal gets thrown around so much, but we've become so, you know, diametrically opposed to each other. So Hatfield McCoy about this whole thing, that we've given up on the notion that there is a reasonable middle. There may not be a gettable electoral, you know, middle, as, you know, like how many independents are really up for grabs. But that's really not what we should be fighting for, you know, because I think that's kind of missing it. Like, then you're just doing an election. It's like, well, how many of independents can I move in this congressional district or that one? And that'll do you for that election, maybe, but it doesn't set the groundwork for any kind of sustained cultural shift in which people are willing to think and talk about things in a way that they feel is constituted by good faith. And they think that comedy and satire are, if done correctly, or even ridiculously, because sometimes the more absurd, the better, because then you're just like, this can't possibly be real. I mean, I make things that I cannot believe people will watch and think that they are real documentaries. That's mind-boggling to me. But that they'll listen to it. They'll go through the whole thing. And even just like one of those things sticks at some point, it's like, oh, there are different ways to think about this. I didn't really put those things together. And maybe they find purchase and maybe they don't with respect to how they vote in that election cycle. And I don't want to overstate like what the influence of this kind of thing would be. I'm really thinking more about if we decided to make a broader concerted effort to establish common ground, not with the crazy people on the side, which we can't do, but the people who hold their nose and vote.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, those are, I hate to use that word gettable. I don't like that word, because there's got to be some element of hope that, like, winning this election and that election, it can't be enough. It can't be enough. It's just like fighting one battle to the next battle, to the next battle. And then it's like, what, until somebody has a majority that's veto proof, that's, I mean, what's the end game there? You know, the end game has to be some transformation of the way that we're able to talk to each other, but more important, listen to each other. And I've just, I mean, my experience is that, like, this has worked a little bit, you know, so I'm going to continue experimenting with it.
I think it's good. And I think, you know, your point about comedy being able to go across boundaries is a good one. And I think not thought of. Did you ever read Sophie's Choice, novel Sophie's Choice?
I saw the movie probably when I was the age that I would have been killed.
Okay. Right. So Sophie's Choice is by Styron, William Styron.
Right.
And it's, as a piece of literature, as a piece of writing, it's so good, because you go into it knowing what the choice is. And it's about, you know, this horrible Nazi concentration camp. So Sophie has to decide which one of her two kids will live. And that's, you know, this going into the book, because you've seen the movie, you know about what the fucking choice is. It's right in the title. And you're thinking to yourself, God, I don't want to read this. This is going to be terrible. I don't want to. Ugh. And you open the book and you start reading it. And it's in Brooklyn and it's after the war and it's fucking hysterical. The first 200 pages of that book are funny as anything. And you're reading it and you're liking everybody and you're like laughing. And then you're just like, oh, fuck, man, I'm in this now. I got to hear about this terrible stuff. And even the way he attacks the thing that happens, he doesn't go on and on about it. It just happens and it's over, because he doesn't have to. I don't know. It's just really well done. But the important takeaway here is the comedy is the way in. I mean, stand-ups do this all the time. They show us that comedy is the way in. That's how you get into people's brains. And you see it with some of these, you know, these right-wing people who think George Carlin is on their side or whatever. It's like, no. You know, he pretty much had you pegged a long time ago.
Yeah.
But they still think it's funny. Even your bugbear, Ted Cruz, you know, he likes Princess Bride. He likes funny things. He clearly likes things that I like. And yet
someone's got to root. Someone's got to root for Humperdinck.
Under the circumstances, I shall sit.
I mean, his wife doesn't like him. This is a very resonant character for him.
I think he likes when people don't like him. So we're coming against the time. So I have a whole list of questions. You've got to none of them, which is fine, because I just wanted to talk and pick your brain anyway. But all right, I want to talk about history for 1 second. So you're familiar with the wide range of cultures, ancient and, you know, up until the present, more than most people. So is there any point in history or any civilization in history that this particular moment in America or / the West reminds you of?
God, I think about this all the time, and I'm trying, you know, and I rack my brain, because the difficulty is that there's never been a parallel that there was this much information at people's disposal, and information is almost never the downfall, if that makes sense. Like the fact that information has been so democratized through every class, every socioeconomic class, means that it's uncharted waters. It would be very easy for me to say, oh, it's just like ancient Rome, and you'll hear anybody make those things. And it's like, I study 5,000 years of history. So for me, it's easier to think of civilizations as 300 year experiments that come and go. And when I look at the United States, I think, well, of course, you know, of course, it's fine. But I will say is that almost all of the collapses are precipitated by unforced errors. They are precipitated at a time when a sense of perspective is lost about what really constitutes catastrophe, aliens from within and without, And, you know, going back to, you know, the 1980s when, you know, Newt Gingrich started to innovate the whole, you know, the fate of Western civilization and democracy are on the line, you know, every time, you know, a rapper got invited to the White House, you know, I think about Bill Riley having 30 shows when Common came to Barack Obama's White House, you know, as being, you know, or the tan suit or, you know, or whatever. Yeah. It's that is that 24/7 outrage machine, which for us, we see how short-sighted that is. But if you really do subscribe to a world in which you see no end game, right? And I think that's the big thing is you and I, because we are sympathetic to the science of climatology, are thinking about points of no return. And so we're thinking about votes for president as being votes for the constituency of the judiciary that is going to be deciding climate legislation and whether it's not already too late, given that every 2 years we're talking about another benchmark or point of no return, which were passed, you know.
Yep.
It's just there is no parallel because there are just all these other kinds of variables at work. But all the other variables that have collapsed all these other civilizations are so much less destructive than the ones at which we're looking right now.
Mm.
That I would say it's sui generis in a sense. It's its own thing. And it does not bode well. I mean, like, I'm a single issue voter for all the things that I want. Like, for me, it comes down to who's in the judiciary. And it's always been that way. Whoever was running in a primary, whether my heart was with this candidate or that candidate, I mean, for me, it's lockstep in November because I know who's going to appoint which judges.
Yeah.
And that's the, nobody remembers who Nixon appointed to the Supreme Court or Carter, you know, I mean, it's presidents come and go. These guys sit here for 30, 40 years. And when you figure that during that time period, there could be three censuses.
Yeah.
Right. And every time there's a census, there's a gerrymander, which means it's another 10 years before the political constituency of a congressional delegation in any given state might have a chance of changing. And if every 2 or 3 years we're up against another point of no return climate threshold, do the math, you know, the last three, I don't really care what anybody feels about Hillary, but the last three SCOTUS appointments, to me, and I'll be totally honest, and I hate to be skeptical, I'm just trying to be real with you, is that pretty much ended any chance of any substantive climate legislation that would pass judicial review that will make any difference with respect to the objectives of capping our collective temperature rise at 2 degrees. Like, that's it. I mean, because let's do pie in the sky stuff. I mean, you know, when Aristophanes talked about utopia, you know, the Greek word means nowhere. I mean,
right.
Utopia doesn't mean utopia. I mean, for that, for the Greeks, utopia meant fantasy land. So let's do the fantasy for a second and say somehow there's a landslide, a filibuster proof landslide. We pass the most sweeping climate legislation you could possibly make with $10 trillion. We like criminalize the oil and gas industry. I mean, everything that you could possibly think of, where does it go? It goes to SCOTUS. Do you trust this court to allow those things to become law? I mean,
are you saying that Brett Kavanaugh can't be impartial? How dare you? The problem is that fantasy doesn't even work. In that fantasy, we would expand the court, but we're never going to. The way that the country was set up with the Senate is rigged against progress. It always has been. And until the system is reformed, which it cannot be.
Yeah.
It's almost reforming the Senate is like what you were talking about the missiles flying out from Moscow. It activates each individual one, and it can't ever be reformed, right? Because reforming it would require the reform to have already happened.
Right. I mean, I told you so is not like a viable political theory. I cannot find that in any Leo Strauss collection.
No.
You know, it's like Quentin Skinner. Did you write about? You know what I mean? Neither is Schadenfreude. I mean, but it's all about scoring things now. It's all about winning now. It's all about, you know, so it's a great question. And I'm sorry, I'm not trying to dodge it, but I do think about this a lot.
Yeah.
And I realize that it just doesn't exist. And I think that's what's most frightening. So there's part of me on one hand that's like, is, you know, wants to embrace the extinction, you know, because like extinction, I mean, like 99% of all species that have ever inhabited the earth by organisms are extinct. There's no reason to think, like, it would be kind of hubris to think that we would escape that, you know, yeah. and that for that matter, Elon Musk would be the mechanism to, you know, to fudge that math. But that, that like extinction is like our only birthright. And I mean, to put a fun spin on it, not to be like too nihilistic, but like how many species, I'm thinking about this because like there's this new work on dinosaurs who died the day of the blast. Like how many species in the history of, or how many individuals in the history of your species are lucky enough to have a front row seat at the extinction of their own species, who like actually get the closure? It's like
I wrote a poem about that one time. Like I did.
I bet it's great.
No, it is not. But the point of it was like, you know, if we're going to go anyway, I mean, it would be kind of nice to all leave at the same time. You know, party's over. Let's go to the exits, you know.
Right. But I mean that like kind of in a constructive way, which is that like, I really believe in like specifically articulated end games to know what's at stake, because then you work backwards. You say, well, like this is statistically speaking, what's most likely going to happen. So when I'm trying to decide, do I vote for Bernie? Do I vote, you know, or I mean, not to, you know what I mean? Like, am I going to not vote? Am I going to hold my, it's like, I have voted in every election, but I've never voted for a president. You know what I mean? Like I voted for an insurance policy.
Yeah.
That masqueraded as a presidential candidate. You know, so I don't know. Like, we're doomed, but I mean that in a positive way. No, there's gotta be some way to like, yeah. I mean, it's not, it's a unique form of self-help, but I think.
I mean, do you think though, am I foolish for thinking that we're just really smart and we'll figure it out when the time comes? And I understanding that we keep thinking that the time comes and we keep blowing by the, you know, like we're in the Thelma and Louise car hurling towards the cliff there. And there are stop signs that we keep blowing past. But
it's funny, like I when you say that, I'm thinking like, well, you know, what does a Dane think about this? You know, like what is or like a denizen of any country that's taking this really seriously. Mm-hmm. And they look at the United States and they're like, you know, we could do anything that we want. We could do 110%, like pretty much 100 countries could do 100%. And it's just like that one country that's going to fuck it all up and make it impossible. And, you know, and then they're looking at our Supreme Court and they're looking at like our march toward authoritarianism and theocracy. And there's, you know, and total rejection of science as if it's witchcraft. And, you know, that's gotta be so disheartening in a way that's different from than our own despair. You know, and I don't know what's better, but that's part of what I'm thinking about is like, you know, look, I could be like, I'm going to go organize grassroots stuff. It's not my bailiwick. Like, it's like, there are certain things that I'm good at. And I think like, I'm good at dick jokes and, you know, historical analogy and, you know, quick cut film editing. And I feel like this is the best use of my time right now. And I know that sounds stupid, but like if we're going to go to circle back from the beginning, is that if we now kind of accept or recognize that like that our political discourse is pretty vulgar right now, then vulgarity seems to be the entree to, you know, camaraderie or empathy, or I can't believe those words just came out of my mouth.
But
I believe them, you know, like, cause I see it working, you know, it's, and, but then I think like, but isn't that what Voltaire was writing about? Like, isn't that like what Rabelais was writing about? Like, you know, I mean, Dickens, for God's sakes, you know, like it's like Ambrose Bierce, like they're all Mark Twain. Like, I bet at some point all of those people in their lifetime thought, this is the last generation because we can't get worse than that. But they all figured out a way to make it funny. You know, like Dickens is hysterical. I mean, I've never seen anybody who can make, you know, jokes about starving urchins funnier. Like, it's kind of like a Dick Cavett.
To be fair, though, that's pretty easy. I mean, it's so much material there.
Urchins are funny, you know, like, yeah,
they're inherently funny. You
know. What's
not funny about gruel?
Consumption writes its own jokes. But even the people that we like tend to think of as being establishment responsible, you know, if we're looking at John Stewart, or if we're looking at even Maureen Dowd, who, no great shakes in my opinion, but like, okay, you got a Pulitzer, you got a, you know, at some point there was a window in which you commanded, you know, respect and influence people or whatever, you know. And then there was a time when, you know, Obama got mad that you made fun of his ears, and that's what became the story. But like, our whole history from Punch, right, you know, to, you know, medieval manuscripts of animals hitting each other, like wearing priest robes, to these like ancient allegories of like, you know, a shovel arguing with a hoe about like who's got the better job, as this allegory of the division of labor in a caste system, because they can't talk about the king because, you know, things will be cut off of them, you know. Or I'll give you kind of interesting example, you know, even in Greek tragedy, there's only one of these that survives, but traditionally you'd have a trilogy of really horrible plays where everybody would be murdered in different ways. But what most people don't remember, because they only one of them survives, by Euripides, is that then you'd have a sadder play at the end, which would be like funny and sexy and like kind of bacchanalia kind of stuff, because people needed the outlet at the end. They needed their release because they just saw some really heavy shit. Now, today we would say too soon because it just happened, but like they actually had a whole like system, right, that like addressed the mass trauma that you just put someone through. And we are in this like strange place where, you know, you've got a school shooting, you've got a plane crashing into something, and it may be our impulse sometimes, you know, to try to tell a joke because that's how we grieve in our own way. I mean, I've got like an incredibly reprehensible gallows humor, which I have to try to keep to myself, but that's how I grieve, you know. And it's not disrespectful. It's just how, because that's my own form of suppression. And I don't think I'm alone in that sense, especially since, like, you know, there was an actual gallows at January 6th, you know. So
yeah,
you right. know, I figure if you can have gallows there, you can have gallows jokes about insurrection. But I mean, so I'm writing the Devon's Cow, as you probably know, is my like one of my creative partners, and okay. We are writing the book, the big book, you know, commercial book together, and we are working on this chapter on like the fear of getting canceled. Like, yeah, at any yeah. moment,
it's a real thing. And totally.
Any of us can be canceled by saying, you know, one tequila too many at 11:30, you know,
yeah.
while you're watching something on TV and tweeting at the same time, in the same way that like we're always just like one bad adverb away from showing up on bad legal takes, you know. All of us, there's no exception.
No, it's yeah, it's true.
And you know, some of it's like I delete so many tweets. I think of it as like the Disney vault. Like, no, I'm just taking it out. Like, maybe later on I'll bring it back out.
Yeah, no, I do
like,
the same thing.
Not all my movies are out there. I'll like put it out there and be like, I'll take it out, put it back in later. But like when the Alec Baldwin shooting happened, mm-hmm. my mind was just, first of all, it's like, this is horrible. But the only way that I can process it, instead of reading about it, because then I'm like going to be sad and like bawl my eyes out, is like, Donald Trump must be so pissed at Alec Baldwin because he actually will get away with shooting somebody. Yeah. You know, bad joke. Yeah, bad joke. I mean, but it worked.
But it worked. Probably, you know, that certainly was in his brain.
But it's too soon. But I think that that's like, I think that we don't really empathize with each other all that well, because I think that's, you know, our id is for the most part only barely restrained these days. And social media has totally started to break down that wall between, you know, the restraint between our, you know, the evil part up here and our mm-hmm. mouth or our fingers. And you know, it makes you think a lot. So we've been like going back over her tweets that she like thought she would get canceled for. Like, this was the one that I thought, and we're trying to break down, like, what was I thinking when I wrote this?
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
You know? And so we're trying to like make like her experience on social media, which in so many ways that people don't appreciate, transformed the way that Twitter works, because there's so much kind of copycat stuff going on, and she didn't really know how to negotiate that at first. It's been kind of a learning curve, and, you know, which was, how do you, you're thrust into the role of folk hero out of nowhere, and like, is there responsibility that comes from that? I mean, she started a shitposting account, you know, against a corrupt congressman, and then suddenly you're the face of free speech in the country.
With great satire comes great responsibility.
With great, that's exactly it. It is. And, Boom. You know, three years since those lawsuits were filed, and they're still ongoing.
No, that's a terrible thing too. I don't even want to get into that. That's too depressing. Well, I don't mind talking about the extinction events, but talking about lawsuits is too depressing. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I wanted to ask you before I release you into the night here.
Oh, can we talk about the pack though?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, so that's because that's kind of the cool thing that's happening. And this will be I think you get the exclusive here because we haven't announced it yet.
Okay. Yeah. I wasn't sure if I should ask about it.
It's great. So Devin's Cow and History Falls, or at least we've partnered together to create a new PAC, new political action committee, that's kind of like founded and kind of like on the Midas template. Adam Parkamenko is a company that like sets these things up. He's kind of like helped us with it. So we're all registered with the FEC and stuff like that. And we're kind of like ready to go. But what we wanted to do was kind of take everything that you and I have been talking about and kind of create a whole different kind of conversation. Like, we want to make political ads. We want to create original content and explainers and whatever the fucked up version of Schoolhouse Rock would look like if it were done by Rick and Morty. You know, we've got musicals planned and cartoons and just all sorts of really strange things, but they're also going to be very serious because we want to be targeting, you know, very specific races and doing candidate endorsements and doing issue advocacy in the states and races where we feel they're most under threat. And what we realized was that the FEC really has no regulations with respect to the role of satire or comedy mm-hmm. in political advertising. And, you know, most political ad agencies are too scared to touch it. And for all the good work that Midas and Lincoln Project and others are doing, there's still kind of things that they can't touch because that's their brand. Well, our brand is a talking cow, you know? So what we've decided is, let us learn our lesson from the vernacularization of everything that we're talking about. If we relate to each other through dick jokes, where is it said that you can't do you know, ads for or against candidates, like at their crassest, if they move the needle. I don't want to make them sound like too terrible, but I mean, we really want to try to innovate a genre that we don't think exists right now.
This is interesting. I like this. Yeah.
Because we do believe that there is a way to communicate with people in the middle that has never been tried because everybody's been particularly careful. And I don't mean that as a criticism, but you know, History Falls is a little, I think, too edgy for what we want to do, but we want to kind of like adapt that tone And that kind of hard-hitting approach and to races that both are critical. Like we want to target statewide races because we think the Senate's really important, maybe a couple of congressional races where, you know, we feel we might be able to make a difference. But one thing that we want to do that I don't see a national effort addressing is the less sexy, quote unquote, races like Secretary of State positions.
Yeah.
And other positions like local positions where people, you know, county election commissioners and stuff like that, who will be in a position to certify the presidential votes in 2024 in a time period where a lot of the people who are running are big lie truthers. And there is now like not particularly any fear about bucking the will of voters and throwing out votes in order to do that. There was a time because of incumbency that people were afraid of what the consequences will be. But now we know that there won't be any consequences. Yeah. You know, I mean, any election commissioner now can be like, you know, Tom Hanks voted and he's dead because I saw him trending on Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, so, and then that's it. And well, let's just throw them up. And of course, if you look at the John Eastman memos, you can see that like, you really don't need a reason at all, right? You do it first. It's easier to get forgiveness than permission, right? You know, get cover fire after the fact. And I think the scariest part about the landscape right now is we traditionally think about this happening exclusively in purple states, you know, battleground states like Wisconsin or Pennsylvania, whatever. But here's the reality is you can have a blue state that happens to have a red legislature.
Yeah.
And because of the way they've gerrymandered, you know, the state Senate and assembly districts, you know, they don't really have to worry about what the backlash is going to be. There can be states where Biden would win re-election by 1.5 million votes, but a Republican controlled, you know, bicameral in that state could still throw out the votes and suffer negligible electoral damage for that in 2026. Doesn't even need to be purple. Yeah. You know?
Well, this is good. I'm glad you guys are doing this. Is there a website or somewhere that
cowpack.com will be launching soon? We hope to have the launch for next week. We're kind of like doing all the last minute like dumb merch store stuff and never entrust a professor with doing administrative stuff. So I've had to like learn, you know, FEC compliance because I'm the one who goes to jail, I think, if anything goes wrong, you know. So I'm trying to be really careful.
See, that's the that's the funniest thing you've said. Nobody goes to jail anymore. Come on. Nobody goes to jail.
But no, I mean, like super PACs are horrible. Like the things that like you're able to do, like the first thing I realized was like the first thing we should do is try to like convince everybody to criminalize the thing we just registered. But we want to kind of be open about it, saying like, do you understand like what like the FEC lets people do? Like when you send your money somewhere, like what they let people do with it? Like this is nuts. So we want to have like real transparency about like how the money is sent. So yeah, there'll be a website, there'll be ActBlue link, and we're going to really hope that people are going to be willing to contribute a little bit because it won't really take that much money, I think, for us to make a difference given the fact that we're doing it all now for free.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I think it's good. It's good work. Okay. So it's CowPac, C-O-W-P-A-C. com. That's going to be live at some point, not long after this episode airs. You can follow you at History Falls. It's History Falls Apart, but the Twitter handle is at History Falls.
At History Falls.
Yeah.
That's right.
Ryan Byrne, thanks so much for taking the time. Great to talk to you.
Thank you, Craig, as always.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Sophia Tereshchenko provided the Russian introduction. Voice talent is provided by Tally Briggs, Signet Della, Stephanie St. John, Brett Petticord, Ryan Byrne at History Falls Apart, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kenai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail website with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the site and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. Until next time, we shall prevail.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.